It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hey, welcome to Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. I am Bradshaw. That's Briscoe over there. How you doing, Mr. Briscoe?
Layfield, I'm doing good, Mr. Shaw.
Mr. Shaw, as the Sheik would say. Mr. Shaw, your boy Brad is such a fine young man.
Yeah. Little did he know.
Other people don't know that we share something that's a bit of a history in wrestling. An 8.6 quarter hour rating, which I think is the highest regular quarter hour ever. There may have been a higher overrun era quarter hour ever, but the highest regular quarter hour we had, we were preempted against WCW, and I wrestled Ron Simmons. The APA wrestled each other in the first part of the hour, and the first part of the quarter hour, and the second part of the quarter hour, you and Pat Patterson were against the Mean Street Posse. And we drew an 8.6. Think about that. These guys today they'd fall all over themselves if they drew an 8.6.
Oh man, they're lucky if they do the 0.6 now, right? You know, that was so much fun back then. And you know, they say you're only as good as your lead in. So fortunately, I had you and Ron leading Pat and I. And those kids with Mean Street Posse, old Pete and Ron and all those guys, what great guys they were, man.
They were awesome. They were really good at what they did.
And they didn't know nothing. I mean, that was the thing about it, tell you. They worked, Trey. I mean, they knew very little, if anything.
But, you know, they fit in right away. As soon as they came in, you know, they were the outsiders. They were Shane's friends. They had all this stuff, you know, you'd think would be against them. Everybody loved those guys.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, that was it. They were just good guys when they come in. You know, they were Shane's buddies, and everybody just, you know, Shane was so well respected and thought of, and wasn't pushy or anything with these guys. You know, he just brought them in, you know, as his little posse, because Vince had the Stooges being R.I.P. Pat Patterson. So Shane brought in his Stooges.
From the mean streets of Greenwich.
I always loved him. You know, Chael Sonnen, the tough SOB in UFC, he advertises himself off of that from the mean streets of Westwood or whatever the hell he lives out in Portland, Oregon, you know. And it's one of those places like Greenwich, you know.
That's right, yeah. I saw Chael Sonnen one day. I got his name wrong. He's hilarious. He talked about the fact that he grew up one time and he couldn't take the Mercedes to school. He goes, "That's what I had to deal with. You tell me I didn't grow up in the hood." It was hilarious.
He's got a real sad poor me story. Oh. You know, I just crack up about Chael is one of the funniest guys there is out there, man.
He's so good at what he does. He's a good fighter too.
Yeah, very good, man. He was a hell of a wrestler at that time.
Hey, I want to ask you about our good friend, Pat Patterson. You know, first, every tribute I've seen to Pat, people talk about him like they're his best friend, because everybody felt like Pat was their best friend, and Pat was. I mean, I talked to guys when I went back to WWE this past week for a tribute to the troops, and everybody that said something about Pat, they talked as if he was their best friend. Pat had that impact on guys, right?
Pat did have that impact, and they were right, they were. But, John, first of all, you know, congratulations to you on that that tribute to the troops. That was your brainchild, and you're the reason why that thing has lasted this long. And for you to be on broadcast TV with this thing, I mean, what a thrill that had to be for you, and just a satisfaction that, you know, that this show is finally getting the recognition that it deserved. It always was. It always was one of the network's favorite shows and best shows. But to be on Fox TV, I mean, that to me, I was really proud of you, and really proud of WWE and the way it's presented.
Yeah, it was such a great show this past Sunday on Fox. Fox did a great job, as WWE did, with presenting the entire show. What was so cool about the tribute to the troops going to Iraq and Afghanistan was that WWE didn't want us just to stay in the green zone. You know, everybody who went to there went to the green zone. They want us to go to all the forward operating bases and actually see and stay, live and eat with the soldiers. And that's one of the things that made it so special, was the fact that we went to forward operating bases, FOBs, as they call them, that most people had never even heard of or had been to. It was really an incredible time to see these guys over there in the deserts of Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, thank you for doing that, John, and thank you for bringing it to the attention of Vince and Kevin Dunn and getting the show done. And, you know, back to our dearly departed friend, Pat Patterson. Everybody thought Pat was his best friend, their best friend, and they were when they were around Pat. When Pat took you and set you aside, he was so focused on you and, you know, what you were saying and everything that he was your best friend at that moment there. And nobody has things to say about Pat. I mean, there's these goofs out there, you know, screw you, you know. Pat was our friend, and we'll fight for Pat Patterson any day of the week, you know.
I'd love when Pat would get worked up. He'd go, oh, the crowd go banana. They all go banana.
You know, I get this question all the time about the Stooges. Pat was, wow, I mean, you know, businessman. I mean, I had the great pleasure of being around guys like Bill Watts, you know, great Finnish guy. Guys like Eddie Graham that taught Bill Watts. I mean, so George Scott, some of these great bookers and some of these great minds in the business. But I never seen one person, and I'm talking 50 some odd years in this old damn wrestling business, man. And so I've seen a bunch of them, but Pat to me, he had the greatest mind for this business anybody had ever walked the face of the earth. And, he had that sense of humor about him too, that was just second to none. Hey, John, you know, I was down the street corner the other day, and there was a group of old cowboys there. And you know who told me to tell you hello?
Who?
Nobody.
Pat got me on that joke, I bet 15 or 20 times over the years. And he'd catch you with it unexpected. I mean, just unexpected. He'd find different ways to set it up. And he'd say, yeah, I was in New York, and I ran into some friends of yours. I was in Texas. Saw a buddy of yours. You know who was asking about you? Nobody.
And he would crack up. I mean, he had another one. And I know you know, and this is done very respectfully to Pat Patterson. But you know, Pat, you know, he lived two lives. You know, he lived the business life of Pat Patterson, WWE superstar and business executive. Then he led his personal life, and how he did that for so many years, you know, without really. There were. Brother Bruce was a rumor and innuendo all the time, you know, about Pat Patterson. But, you know, when you see him one-on-one and you talk to him, you sit down and you get him in that wrestling building, that's all you thought about was Pat Patterson, the wrestler, yeah. Not Pat Patterson, personal guy. So,
did you guys ever work with him and Ray Stevens? You know, he went out and worked out in California, the Cow Palace, mainly. Now, he also worked in Portland, I think, for Don Owens, but he worked out there with Mad Dog at Cow Palace with Ray Stevens. Did you guys ever work with him? They also worked AWA as well.
Yeah, that's, you know, John, that's really a nice, I say this with much sincerity. That's one of my biggest regrets in the business, that Jack and I are myself and anybody. I mean, we worked with Patterson and Stevens, I think, in Carolina. But, both of them were at, you know, at the tail end of it. I never really got to see Ray at his peak or Pat at his peak. First time I ever ran into Pat Patterson, you know, I was like everybody else when I started in the business. You know, you're those little local town that we grew up in, small towns. You had the magazines, those after magazines. And so you'd go look, and, you know, Pat and Ray were just setting records in San Francisco Cow Palace. And I want to ask you a question about Cow Palace a little bit later. But, you know, you see all these pictures of Ray and Pat, you know, and I mean, they're drawing 15,000 people a week back in the, you know, in the early 70s, which is wow. I mean, this is every week, not once a month or every 3 months you go to a big major market. They're running at San Francisco Cow Palace weekly. And, you know, the great thing about it, I got to sit in that car with Pat many, many nights, and I'd ask him, just tell me a story about the Cow Palace. He'd tell me about Alpha and Seeky, you know, when they were like kids, you know, little kids out to watch the great Chief Peter Maivia perform in the Cow Palace. Well, they'd be sitting up in the rafters. Pat would get so much heat on them, those two big ass Samoans would jump over the damn balcony and come in the ring, and Pat would have to fight them as kids. So it was wild, but I got to listen to all those stories with Pat like that, and what a phenomenal storyteller.
Yeah, what a phenomenal storyteller. He tag teamed later with Rocky Johnson as well, was a tag team champion in one of the territories of Rocky, right?
That's right. He was in San Francisco, I think, and also I think he did a little bit in the Carolinas. They teamed back up. I'm not sure on that, but I know that's how Rocky, maybe it was Oregon, but that's how Rocky really got his name in the United States, was tagging up with Patterson.
Oh, really? I wasn't aware of that. That was Rocky's first big break.
That was Rocky's first big break. It really was to be with tag team with Patterson there.
What was the deal between Pat and Gorgeous George? I don't know if you ever heard this. I asked Pat about Gorgeous George a few times. You know, he was bound down in L.A. at the Olympic Coliseum, and he was kind of pretty much done. I think he did his retirement match in 1962, I believe it was, where he got his head shaved, but he was 50 years old at the time, a little bit past his prime. Pat didn't think much of George. He talked about how he drew money in L.A., but he didn't draw money anywhere else. Did you ever hear that talk to Pat about George, or that friction that there kind of was between the two competing draws, Pat up in San Francisco and George down in L.A.?
Well, you know, that's an interesting story there. I know I'd answer your question. I never talked to Pat about that, and I wish I would have, because I really wasn't aware. But I was always aware of the friction, it seemed like, between Southern California wrestling and Northern California wrestling. I mean, those guys, I mean, you talk to them, and very few of them crisscrossed each other. You were either a star in San Francisco or you're a star in Southern Cal. It didn't seem like they mixed or matched their talent out too well. And I think a lot of that was because Roy Shires really didn't want those guys coming up there and stealing his game plan, you know, how he ran his operation, which I kind of wished I would have gone out there. When I was in Australia working for Jim Barnett, and I'd sign like everybody else to go down there for 2 to 3 months and then, you know, come back to the United States. Well, I was a rookie. I was just starting in the business. I got lucky because Jack was down there, and Barnett fell in love with Jack and Jack's work and everything. So Jack told him about me that I was just starting in the business. He said, come on down. So I went down there, and I ended up, like I said, ended up staying for 11 months down there when I signed up for like an 8-week tour down there. And Barnett liked me and I liked my work. But I got to work with all those guys. But when it come time for me to leave, I was kind of wondering, you know, I was welcome in Florida, but I really didn't want to go there. And because Jack was such a big star there that I just didn't want to go and be that guy at that time, you know. So I stayed away from there. So I had a chance to go to Carolina, which I ended up going. But Barnett was friends with Roy Shire, and he had really pitched me hard to go into San Francisco. And also the Von Steiner brothers were in, the old Von Steiner brothers were in Australia at the time. they were hot in Oregon, and Don Owens, that was another place I kind of wanted to work. But I never ventured out there. And the only reason I really wanted to go to San Francisco was because of Pat Patterson and Ray Stevens. I just, you know, I'd heard all the horror stories about how Roy Shard would holler at you for perfection. But hell, you know, we were college athletes. You know how the coaches holler at you anyway. So, you know, what's another guy? But this one paying you some good money to holler at you. So that didn't bother me. But the big thing that really excited me was, man, I'm going to go out there and get to see the Pat Patterson and Ray Stevens. But anyway, Crockett's offered me a great deal, so I went out there and stayed out there most of my career.
Were they recognized by everybody as pretty much the best? I mean, Bret Hart said they're the best tag team of the 70s. Were they recognized pretty much by everybody in all the different territories that Pat and Ray, that's the cream of the crop?
Well, as you know, guys working in the South, I mean, you know, as you know, and you know, the guys working up for Vern and guys working other places, and especially Carolina, they always have their favorite tag team. But among the boys, among their peers, I mean, when I was getting rolling and everything, I was always told, you know, by the veterans. I was lucky because I was in Oklahoma and a lot of people were passing through. It was, you know, that's a crossing point, that in Texas, you know, going east and west. They would drop down, work for Leroy and Fritz and Paul down in South Texas. But that was the thing, you know, among their peers, you'd always hear Patterson and Stevens, Stevenson and Patterson, you know. And then on tag teams, you know, if you're in a tag team, you know, the Torres brothers, Ramon and Ricky Torres, they come through Oklahoma and they were, you know, hot out in California. And they were always, you know, talking about it. The Kozaks, Jerry and Nick, you know, from West Texas, two of my favorite people, taught me so much in this business. I owe so much to, you know, they, as good as they were, I mean, it was Stevenson, Patterson to them also. And then moving down to Florida and Georgia and Carolinas, that was the name that was synonymous with tag team wrestling. And so, yeah, I would say they were probably the best tag team, you know, among their peers of all time.
Going back just a little bit real quick to Gorgeous George and the L.A. and the rivalry between L.A. and San Francisco, which, you know, George never drew big money. Now, he drew massive money in the Coliseum. In fact, they called them Georgie sets when TV sets first came out because they claimed that George sold as many TV sets as Milton Berle. You know, Gorgeous George was huge, but he never drew outside, really, of Southern California. When he went to the East Coast, he was not that successful. I don't know, for whatever reason, but Pat was that, what was the difference between the two territories? Did the LA group not really draw outside of Los Angeles and not really care to?
Well, I don't think as a group, because, you know, you look at some of the stars that came out. I mean, we're talking really early guys, and you're right, they didn't. But, you know, the difference in style, and it's going to sound different in today's world, was that entertainment. San Francisco had those hard-ass old-school wrestlers, Ray Stevens, Pat Patterson, you know, Gomez, all those guys that could go, you know, and they flip-flopped a lot with Oregon because Don Owens had that same mental philosophy, you know. Shoot, Don Owens' brother would pay the guy $5 extra, $10 extra to go out and take down somebody. Then the guys, of course, would work and split the $10, you know. So
that's great.
And so then you're talking about Southern California, where it's all Hollywood. You know, it's the Georgie pins, it's the robes and all that. And back in our day, John, in early days, you know, my days, it was just when all that stuff was starting to phase out. But wrestling was real, you know, and the fans wanted to see it as real. And outside of Hollywood, you know, where it was entertainment, they were probably the only entertainment company in the wrestling business at that time.
Well,
if that makes any sense.
Later, Memphis got that kind of that reputation, you know, that
exactly.
Ha-ha reputation.
And they were kind of looked down on from the NWA bigwig on the entertainment that they were doing there. But Lawler got it. You know, Lawler got it. I think he was such a fan of George and that old that style of West Coast wrestling that, you know, he kind of incorporated into what he did there.
Yeah. Well, you know, Lawler was actually going to wrestle Elvis in a wrestler versus MMA match, a wrestler versus judo match, before Elvis passed away. I mean, that's how big Lawler was in Memphis at the time.
Yeah, well, you go back even further, Sputnik Monroe, and Elvis used to come to the Coliseum to see Sputnik Monroe wrestle, and they wanted to be tag team partners.
Unbelievable. You know, that thing with Andy Kaufman, it's still the time TV Guide said it's one of the top 25 TV pieces of all time.
Wow.
And he slapped Andy Kaufman on the David Letterman show, and it was unbelievable time.
And Jerry got so much heat for doing that. You know, what are you doing getting this Hollywood guy in our business? What are you doing exposing? You're telling everybody. You know, they talk about exposés and everything. You know, think about these little bits and pieces that were leaking from territories like that. I mean, you know, get this Hollywood actor involved. What the hell does he know about wrestling? You know, I mean, there was some heat on that from the NWA powers.
How did it work when you were at WWE? You sold Georgia Championship Wrestling to Mr. McMahon and made what Vince McMahon says a fortune off of him. Worst deal he said he ever made. The best deal you ever made is what Vince says. But then you're part of the first WrestleManias. Bruce Pritchard comes along at the same time. Pat Patterson has moved from being an in-ring talent, you know, had the great bunkhouse brawl match with Sergeant in the Madison Square Garden, but now he's a road agent. But you had Bruce and Vince and Pat were three of the creative minds, along with you, the main agent. How did that dynamic work in the starting of the WrestleMania era?
I tell you what strange bedfellows that group of people that you just mentioned. I mean, how they got together was just by chance, I think. But each one of us had a specific skill that we could bring to the table. And you know the old man, he don't bring you to the table unless you got something to offer. You know, he just don't bring you there because he likes you. So each one of us had something special that he needed. But that dynamic, I mean, I used to sit in that car with them. I mean, and it sometimes it was so funny just to watch Pat just harass Vince without Vince even knowing that Pat's harassing him. And me and Bruce are just sitting there to crack it up to ourselves. I mean, he would just go off on a tangent, you know, just some really strange angles or figures that we're talking about. And sometimes Vince would get to start enhancing Pat's ribs, you know. But, you know, it was great. And after every garden show, we'd all get in a limo or get in a car. We'd go to one of Vince's steakhouses that he had stay open for him, especially after hours. And so it was basically just us and these big fancy ass steakhouses. And we'd start drinking some wine, and Pat, the more wine that was consumed, the funnier Pat would get. And sometimes he'd get so hilarious, so on Vince. I mean, he was on Vince. He wasn't, you know, a lot of people take Pat wrong. Pat was not a yes man in the company by any stretch of the imagination. Pat would voice his things, and sometimes Pat would get a little emotional and a little wild, you know, pitching his idea. But we get in those steakhouses some of the late nights, and Pat would get going. Vince would just say, "Pat, I've had enough. You know, go home." He's not involved. But we had the three of those guys, they were arguing all the damn time. There was never, especially Pat and Bruce. I mean, they I think they just liked to argue. I think they did that just to kind of show Vince that they didn't always agree with each other. But I would go out to either Pat's house. I would never go to Bruce's house because he lived in a little apartment there at the time. He was a single guy. And you talk about funny. Now we're talking Bruce Pritchard, Abdullah the Butcher size back in the early 70s, you know. I mean, he's big now, but Bruce was big back then. He had this little bitty Saab or Subaru, you know, those little bitty box cars, you know, that they put an engine somewhere in it, wherever they could find little vacant spot, watching Bruce open that door, put that seat way back, and if he had a briefcase, it was bigger than a car, he's trying to fit that briefcase in there, then get his big gas and then a driver's seat on there. By the time he'd get it, I'd be over the corner like it is of the shotgun seat. We go over to Pat's house. We'd sit there, and I tried this several weeks, and Vince, wanting me to get involved in it. And I get over there with these guys. I mean, I'm away from home. They're both living in Stanford. I'm still living in Florida. And Vince is trying like hell to get me to move to Florida. And I just Connecticut. And I'm telling him the only thing good about Connecticut is I-95 South. And, he didn't have a sense of humor on that. But the argument Pat and Bruce would get in to over nothing. So we'd sit there. We're trying to do some booking and some TV writing, some creative. And they would start to bullshit, and holy cow, I'd sit there and listen. Guys, come on, let's focus. Let's get to work so I get to the damn airport and get the hell out of there. Then when I'd tell them, I had an airplane, then the delay system would really start, We were supposed to do a show. We'd maybe do one segment, maybe two segments. Okay, we're burnt. Let's go, Pat, let's go get a vodka, and then we'd go get a vodka or something like that. But they spend more time arguing and they would working. But when it came time to really work and really Vince really didn't have any deadline because you never knew when he was going to work, when he wanted to work or anything. So you made yourself available. So, but Bruce and Pat and Pat would get on to Bruce just so bad and just get Bruce would turn bright red. He'd get so hot wanting to say something. But, Pat was just so superior over him all the time. It was quite a show.
What did you think about when you first heard the Royal Rumble?
I was like everybody else. I was an old traditionalist. But I knew, you knew right away where he's coming from San Francisco. They're once a year. They had one a year, and it started off their new year with or in the end of the year. I forgot exactly which way it was, but that was their battle royal, and they bring in guys from all over the country. So it was always a big deal. And as a talent back in those days, you always kind of wish that phone would ring with that area code on it. And it'd be Shire, and one of those guys pick up the phone. Hey, we'd like you in San Francisco. I never got the invite, but my brother was when they were grooming for the world championship. He participated in them. He loved it. They'd bring Andre in. They bring all the novelty action from all over the United States, and they'd have this battle royal. So we knew what Pat was trying to get at, and when he started saying the time limits and all that stuff on guys entering, I mean, we settled for 30 right away because that's kind of what Roy always had out in San Francisco. So the number wasn't a deal, but how to get a battle royal started, it's always awkward, and it always goes to cartoon, when there's 30 guys out there, that first bell rings, everybody's kind of, you know how it is, you're kind of grab asses, you're trying to get to the right guy that you want to lean up against the rope with and kind of stay out of danger's way. So it's a little, a little cluster there in the beginning. So that, if we just had two guys started out, that's not too bad. And then, guys coming in 30. But then you start to think, holy shit, that's going to take forever. Every minute of 30 guys, that's going to take forever. What's going on in it? What was going on inside with all these little subplots that Pat had come up with. So it was the concept was interesting as hell. From what I understand, Vince was just shaking his head no at every turn. But we're getting involved with NBC and Dick Ingersoll and Lou Del Prete of Saturday Night Live fame. And they had a meeting with Pat and Vince. I don't know if Bruce was there or not, but I wasn't part of that meeting when Ingersoll probably said, "Man, that makes good for good TV." But shortly after that, I remember receiving a call from Pat telling me, "Hey, they're going to go for it." And I said, "Go for what?" And he said, "My Royal Rumble." And I'm saying, holy shit. But I writing those things with Pat, you know, was so much fun. But anyway, Ebersole then was charged with making sure that Vince McMahon went along with the routine. And so, you know, Vince always wants to tweak with things. So he started tweaking with the time and all that stuff. But fortunately, you know, we didn't have our own network at the time. So we were under NBC's restraints. So it had to be a certain time limit. And this minute and a half, this 90 seconds worked out just right for breaks and all that stuff for NBC. So Dick did his best pitch job, and Vince went with it. And man, here we are still doing it in 2020. You know?
Did you ever, were you ever part of the battle royal that Pat put together? Pat told me about it many times. He had a picture of it with Luthez. He brought back a bunch of the old guys for one big battle royal. Vince didn't think it could be done, and Pat wanted to get it done, and he got all of the great old names into one battle royal. And there's even some old pictures of it. Do you know what I'm? Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. That's what pissed Randy Savage off, right? I mean, for years, because his dad wasn't invited. No, but, I wasn't. I was working for the company at the time. But John, when I first started with the company, I was doing local promotion. The WWF or WWE was expanding at the time in the South. The NWA had such a strong stranglehold on all the buildings and all the building managers. You know how these building managers, they kind of work in a group, they kind of reason they go from here to here, you know, and you form a bond and a relationship with these building managers because you work with them weekly. There weren't too many, and it's still now there's hard none, but there weren't too many weekly shows coming to these buildings that would keep your building occupied for 51 weeks out of the year. So the building managers were really, really loyal to the NWA group because of the fact that they're putting events on 52 weeks out of the year in their buildings and their facilities. So when an outsider comes in and went, hey, I want to rent your building for wrestling. Well, how many shows? I mean, one, maybe two, you know, if we get lucky. Building managers just look at, hey, I got somebody here doing 52 weeks a year. I'm not going to risk their loyalty for bringing you in. That was the WWF business model at the time. You go in once every 4 months, and you know if it's a big town, you're twice a year. But most of the town in the South were, you know, so the max that you could offer these guys were four shows, you know, and that was kind of stretching it. And so these building managers weren't really playing games, but through my association with ownership in Georgia and Florida and having a great relationship with the Crockett family and the Carolinas, I always was in on the business side of meeting these building managers and stuff like that. So I formed a relationship with them. So when WWE wanted to start expanding into the South, like I said, they were having trouble getting the buildings. Well, Barnett knew that I had that relationship with the building. So he told Vince about it. Vince picked up the phone and said, hey, and I was retired at the time. You know, I just made my Green Saturday sale with Vince. So I was kicked back here at home and I wasn't really caring, you know, to go to work. But, you know, the guy offered me, hey, I'd like to get Tampa going, Miami going, Orlando. I'd like to get Florida going. And if we get that going, I'd like to get up in the South. And so there'll be some expansion. But we need a local promoter, somebody that the buildings trust. That at the time, I didn't put it all together, you know, the task that I was handed, you know, to persuade all these building managers to jump with us. So. And WCW is still going on at the time and still renting the building pretty frequently. So that's basically how I started out with it. But, the Rumble, I believe when Pat did it, I was supposed to run a show, one of those Saturday night main events here in Tampa at the USF Sun Dome. And one of the thing is, I think I still got the chair. I don't know if it's the second or first or second or one of the first three. I still got one of those souvenir chair, the Royal Rumble, Tampa, Florida, in it. So I got to promote it. excuse me. and see Pat firsthand, but how he put everything together. And you know how corporate WWE is. I mean, you got 10 pages for one segment of the show. Pat would come in just with all 30 guys in his head, and he'd start rumbling and thinking, okay, John, you're going out here. And John, before you go out, you throw Briscoe out and all this stuff. I mean, and you know, he had it all figured out. And hey, he didn't have everything scribbled down on a sheet of paper. Well, the guy was just pure genius on that.
Well, the battle royal though with say Luthez, I think maybe Don Leo Jonathan was in it. Savage's daddy was not. That was not a televised event, right?
No, that was not. That was a house show, and I think it was in Newark at the old building they had. What was the name of that building in Newark? But they ran that was where they had it. And Poffo was not invited to the show. But I don't know if you ever saw a report on it. Out of those 20, 30 old timers that he had in there, I think they had to rent out St. Joe's Hospital there. I think four of them got there. I think Scarpa broke his ankle. Another guy Jim Myers broke his finger or something. I mean, it was a medevac situation there. Nobody seriously. I mean, you know, just nicks and bruises, but. From what I understand, you know, the house show, I mean, it grew big. I mean, it was
all the old legends. You know, Pat had put all these old legends together. Vince didn't think Pat could get all these old legends because Vince had just basically taken over all the territories, and he thought there was a lot of animosity there. But every one of them Pat called came in and did the battle royal.
Well, you know the old wrestler thing. I mean, you're not going to turn down a payday. And these old timers, they saw the writing on the wall. You know, the Vince was taking over, and the territories were drying up left and right. So you get that call. You know, you want to be in a battle royal making. You know, you never turn down a payday, especially when you're an old timer. And you know, there's not a lot of them out there. So there were a few shockers. You know, guys like Fez. You know, showing up for it. I mean, that was probably the big shocker, you know, that Lou showed up for it. But,
well, Mr. Briscoe, thank you for another week of stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw.
Well, John, it's always a pleasure. You know, we're here to remember Pat, and you know, just a quick story, and I'll tell this story. You know, Pat, a Canadian, but he loved the Western history of the United States. And you know, he always, you know, like you do, you know, proud Native American. You know, I'm pretty good with history and some of that stuff, you know, with Native Americans, you know. So, you know, we were driving along. We're somewhere in the Dakotas where it's just colder and shit. And, you know, we're just telling road story to Pat. You know, it amazes me, you know, there's not ice to throw on the ground out there. You know, Native Americans, they used to live out here in, you know, in damn huts and teepees and all that stuff. He said, oh, you know, Africa, how did you guys survive that? Those little loincloths, you know, those little things that you. He said, you think there was any gay Indians out there? I said, well, you know, Pat, we did side with the French for a while, so who knows?
Being a French Canadian. Pat told me when he wrote his book, he said, big news come, you know, I'm coming out. I said, coming out of what? And he said, well, the closet, you know, I'm gay. I said, well, Pat, I know you're gay, but so does everybody else. He said, no, they don't know. And I said, Pat, it's not a secret.
And, you know, that was a great thing about Pat Patterson. You know, we're going to extend this, you know, as usual. Hey, Conrad, hey, WWE, you're listening. We can entertain her. So that was another thing, Pat. So anyway, what was you saying there so I can finish my
Pat, wait, tell me he's coming out of the closet, but people had known for decades. Nobody cared.
Yeah, so, you know, we're making these road trips, and all the time I'm saying, Pat, you know, come on, you know, why don't you have a good time? You know, he's starting to go on these cruises, but he's, you know, he's going by himself. I said, you know, Pat, you know, I'm sure you meet guys on these cruises. You know, he's going to sing karaoke, and he's going on a brand only cruise, you know. And I said, meet somebody, you know, and enjoy the rest of your life. You know, this is at the Stooges time, you know, when we're both up there, you know, business. I said, Pat, you're the only person that you're kayfabing is yourself. Everybody in this damn company knows what you want, what you are.
Yeah, no one cared.
And nobody really cared. People like you at Pat Patterson, they don't care what you are. So Pat, enjoy yourself. He said, he protected the business so damn much because he didn't want anybody having anything to say about him whatsoever. So, you know, when Pat was in that business mode, I mean, he was Pat Patterson, man, right straight to you, you know. But when he go to his personal life, I wanted him to enjoy himself. And I was so happy when he finally told me he was going to write that book and come out, you know.
Yeah. You know, Pat tells a story all the time about him and Mad Dog Bashan and Louie. Where Mad Dog actually was driving down a sidewalk trying to run over Louie. And finally, Louie gets in the car, and Mad Dog and Louie become best friends. And Louie has a spot at all of the wrestling matches and all that. And, you know, it was a great story about Pat out in San Francisco.
And you don't want Mad Dog upset with you, you know. But he's chasing Louie down. Louie's running, hiding behind these garbage bins and all that stuff. And Mad Dog's hitting him with his car and all that stuff. Then they turn out to be best friends. So, you know, it's the person, you know. And we all know what kind of man Pat Patterson was. So, salute, my brother.
Salute. Thank you, Mr. Briscoe.
Thank you, John.